How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. I hope everybody's doing well and staying healthy and getting vaccinated and still wearing their masks. And in just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Sanjana Sethian, who has this incredible book called Gold Diggers. And if you have not heard of this book, you will. And if you're thinking about buying any book, go buy this book. It's one of the most innovative, creative things I've read in a long time. It's coming of age, it's identity, it's what life is like in America these days. And it just has stuff in there that you could never think of. It's fabulous. We'll be talking to her. In the meantime, we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work. We have David Aldrich, who needs a haircut, but not a glass of wine.
No.
And right. Louis Byard, one of our favorites.
Shut that down, David. She really shut that down.
It's the way David's wine glass and my mug kind of fill up the entire screen.
It's like, did I do the SCTV bit? It's like made me laugh out loud when I was a kid. They used to do the fake 3D movie and they would go, would you another glass? And they would just do this.
Okay, that makes me think of this, which I promise we'll get on to our show. Mm-hmm. Has anybody seen the segment from Saturday Night Live, The Iceberg?
Oh, my God.
Oh, brilliant. That was hysterical. Brilliant. That was brilliant. Really funny. Yes.
One of the best
that
things
guy's really funny.
Ever.
Oh, hilarious.
Yeah.
Hilarious. Yeah.
From conception to execution.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. Yes. And the fact that he was releasing an album was the perfect. Was that call it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I've got really an album funny. Out. I hope you like it.
Yeah. So that's the epitome of anything about the Titanic is the epitome of what is it? Louis, you probably know this. Time plus tragedy equals humor, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Tragedy.
Everybody, including me, can and does make fun of the Titanic and make jokes. And there's humor about it. There was a freaking Broadway musical.
Because we all cried at the damn movie. We were all weeping in the damn movie when the two old people were spooning on the bed and all this stuff that the iceberg mentioned.
I didn't weep either. You know, I couldn't wait for that movie to be over.
It was a fine movie. Don't get me wrong. I liked the movie, but it didn't make me cry. You know what? It made me angry. And I've said this many times before.
This is an important public service announcement. Go, David.
It made me angry.
Yeah,
there was plenty of room on that piece of wood for two people.
God damn it. Like, let him up on it. I'm not with.
Jesus Christ. Just make some room, will you?
Selfish bitch. Jesus.
Guys, they're two little thin people. Come on.
I know people who have been out in the ocean with essentially rafts, and they'll recreate that scene, right?
Going, like, we both fit. Yeah.
Okay. So we have several things we want to talk about before we get to Sanjana. But Louis Byard, you've been very, very busy, and we're going to spend a lot of time talking about you and Pale Blue
really?
Eye and what's going to
oh,
happen
gosh,
with
okay.
your great book, Pale Blue Eye. But can we talk about Disha Filia first?
We can. She is the winner of the Penn Faulkner Fiction Award, which is coming out, and I should absolutely have this right at the top of my name.
Because you are the chairman of the award. Secret Lives of Church.
Talk amongst yourselves while I Google this stuff.
Well, so she was, just so you know, she was on this show before she was nominated and then
actually,
won the Penn Faulkner Award.
I didn't know that. What the thing I love... One of the things I really love about her success is that her book was published by University Press, the West Virginia University Press.
Right.
I'm sure this is the biggest bestseller they've ever had. And I think it's just so wonderful that it's a non-commercial, non-New York, non-traditional house that is having this major breakout success with her. And I love the book and I'm thrilled for her.
And she's a fabulous person. Okay, tell us a little bit about that process because that's fascinating to me. So you think about the Academy Awards. And we know the big studios put on campaigns to build hype around their movie so they win the Academy Award and their actors and actresses do. Does the same thing happen with the publishing houses?
I think on a much lesser level. I think it comes up mostly as advertising in the New York Times Book Review or something like that. You don't get anywhere near the hardcore press because the stakes, the financial stakes are less, maybe that's why.
Yeah.
But no, I think Disha's success has really caught everybody off guard. And that's why I'm saying this, the really gratifying success stories are the ones that weren't preordained, right? There are these books that become bestsellers or critical successes and nobody saw them coming. And that's
the
when
upsets.
You really-
Everybody loves
it. It is the upset. We love the upset. We love the upset. Yeah. So.
How many works of fiction were considered for this category?
The judges looked at something like 430 books.
Holy cow. What does looked at mean?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't
pass their hands
too
over it.
Well, here's the thing, and I want to ask this of you guys too. Yes. Don't you feel when you open a book, like you know within 10, 20, 30 pages, is this a book that's good? Is this a book I want to keep reading? Is this a book that, right? I feel like sure. I feel like it announces itself pretty early in the process. Uh-huh. Yeah, David, do you agree?
Yes, definitely I think in that category. I think so, because there's lots of books that I've read 10 pages.
Yeah, right?
That might be me. It might be available.
The first paragraph alone is like, no, I don't think so. So I think there probably is some, I can't speak for them, but I'm sure there is some immediate decision that happens when you get confronted with a book. It's like,
right.
Give it 5 pages, 10 pages, 20, however many they do. But I'm sure there's also a bunch they read through all the way to the end. And I've heard their deliberations at sort of at a remove, and they really struggle. They really struggle to find the best ones. And so my hats are off to them. Because
they all seemed entranced by her book as we were, right?
Yeah.
You know, if it's nonfiction, it's written by anybody in the DMV. You read the first 5-10 pages and you're completely bored. And then you flip to the index in the back to see if your name's there.
Wait a minute. Are they listening? Did you just insult our listeners by saying, what did you just do?
No, we know how pretentious we are here.
Exactly. People of the book here on Chatter on Books. Okay, Lewis. All right. We're very happy for Disha.
Yes.
Very happy that Little Chatter on Books was able to launch her incredibly successful.
Yeah, that's what it was.
The way we did.
Yeah.
And she's a Pittsburgh gal. That makes me so happy. She's Pittsburgh.
Oh no, and I just love the fact this is it's the little book that could. I don't mean to minimize it. It's just like how did this as I said, a university press book just sort of get vaulted? And it clearly is just her talent and her her book.
Yeah.
So well, a university. I'm not so a university press. I thought that was fairly like big time prestigious. Is that in the book publishing world? Is it not?
No, it's prestigious, but it's not. When we talked about the pressure that Tori was talking about earlier about, it's the commercial houses who are trying to push their books out, and they have the money and they have the heft to make that happen. And university presses usually have very little promotion for their books because they just don't have the money to do that. So as I said, for one to really get to vault over that barrier, that money barrier really is.
That's
encouraging
great.
When it happens.
Well, good for them too.
What pressure is put on you, Lewis, as chairman of the Penn Faulkner Awards?
Nothing.
Any money? Anybody offer you anything?
If only that had happened. No, I've had no kind of crisis of conscience or anything like that in the last
darn.
Year. But no, I just my job is basically to hire the judges and make sure that they're decent, good people who will do the right thing.
And how do you hire them? How do you decide who gets to be a judge?
Lots of sifting through names and talking to other people. And I honestly, this sounds weird, but I look for nice people. Because
it's weird about that.
Well, because
David and Claude and I are available, by the way. You buy us a bottle of wine.
Who can collegially discuss these things and come to collegial discussion, because there's no point and this has happened in the past with Penn Faulkner. It's like judges like go to war and they stop talking to each other. It's like, this is silly. This is why be this way?
We're not splitting atoms, people. We're talking about
I never knew. Yeah, I never knew.
So,
You know, it's like academia. What is it? The fights are so big because the stakes are so small.
Exactly. That is exactly right.
Okay. Exactly right. Now we can talk about my favorite number of the evening, 55.
Ah, yes.
So, Lewis, we did talk about you a few weeks ago when we didn't get an email, we didn't get a text from you about the big news about your book, Pale Blue Eye.
When we telepathically, I sent it to you. Did you not get the telepathically?
Yeah, missed it. Shockingly missed it. It's in my spam folder or whatever that's called. We did brag about you. Your original appearance on Chatter on Books was about Courting Mr. Lincoln, which also should be a TV show. We did brag about you a few weeks ago because... you share with our listeners what's happening with Pale Blue Eye. your wonderful story about West Point and murders and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe. It's being turned into a movie, a Netflix movie, with starring Christian Bale and directed by Scott Cooper, who directed Crazy Heart and Black Mass and things like that. So.
And the Trial of Chicago 7, right? Isn't that his?
No, that's the production company. It's the same production company as the Trial of Chicago 7, yeah.
Okay.
So it was It was long and happening and out of the blue at the same time. The option was kind of in and out of force for a while, and then suddenly it happened. And it was Christian Bale who made it happen. He suddenly was able to do it for whatever reason, and here it is. Here we are.
Okay. So that's speaking of long, according to Deadline, the movie which Cooper has wanted to make for more than a decade.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, he was the first option back in 2007.
Wow.
And he dropped it after.
We've had so many authors on, God bless them, so much of their stuff has been optioned, which we all know is the first step of many.
It is just the first step. Thank you for specifying that.
How did you find out, however many years ago it was? Did someone call you?
There's a little money that's sent your way. So
How little? David, take notes. This is going to be you soon, honey.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Hope so.
I think the first thing was just like, I think it was just like 10,000 initially. It was just for a year and then it kind of evaporated and all that stuff. So
that allows them to hold it. Is that correct?
They managed to hold it for a year. So an option is just to say that we get this book for a year and we'll go away and try to make something happen. And 99% of the time, nothing happens. So every agent I've ever had has always said, please don't put any stake in this. So
yeah.
So he came back, the same guy came back 15 years later and said, let's try to make this happen again. It's like, yeah, right.
Okay, but in the intervening...
My dog is, by the way, coming through. That's why my door is mysteriously
open.
That's okay. In the intervening 9 years, 14 years, whatever it was, were you allowed to do something with it since they didn't come back to you in that first year?
Correct. I there's nothing I can do with it, but if somebody else wanted to, they could have, and nobody was banging down the door. It's such a strange thing. Yeah.
What'd you spend the $10,000 on?
It's really none of your business.
Just among us. Yeah. Just among us.
I mean, yeah.
No. I'm going to give you
it was all legal. Whatever. It was all legal. I'm pretty sure it was all legal.
Yeah, probably. Your agent, lawyers probably chewed up most of it. Yeah. Okay.
The tax man chews up that stuff too.
Right.
Here's something else I read. This is according to Deadline. The deal marks a record for a worldwide deal at the European film market. I have no idea what this is.
I don't know what that means either. Yeah.
But Netflix beat out multiple competitors.
Was a whole scrum about it. And by the way, I knew nothing about this. Somebody had to send me the link because I was never consulted. I knew nothing through the whole time, which shows you how important the author is in this whole transaction.
Yeah,
Do you remember the whole joke about the actress who was so dumb, she slept with the writer? That's exactly what we're talking about. That's how low in the hierarchy you really are. Yeah.
Do you have any involvement in the making of this?
A little bit. I've just recently talked with the writer director, and he very kindly sent me the script with invited my input, and it's like, here's the question, guys, because he might be listening, but how sincere is that offer? Like, tell me, I want your sincere opinion. Does he really want my sincere opinion? What do you think?
I think anytime somebody asks you for a sincere opinion, it's just code for no. I really don't want you to tell me what you really think.
I think they want it. They want your opinion, but they may not act on it.
And that's fine.
Never act on it.
The check is cleared. The check is already cleared.
Right.
So we're good.
So it's all good.
Okay, when you first wrote Pale Blue Eye, which is fabulous, by the way, did you envision in your brain what the characters would look like? Did you envision Christian Bale?
Yes, but they've aged out because that book came out 15 years
ago.
Nice,
so ageism. We don't do that on this show.
I think I had Johnny Depp in my mind, and they're both, Gene Hackman is now retired, and Johnny Depp is Johnny Depp. So,
yes.
Yeah. There are many ways he should be retired.
Yes.
Okay. Will you come back and give us updates on it?
Of course. Absolutely.
Awesome. Will you invite us to the premiere?
Thank you for asking. Thank you.
Will you invite us to the premiere?
If I can, I absolutely will.
Oh, man.
If I'm invited, who wants the fucking writer, you know?
I hope it's in New York. I don't want to go all the way out to LA to get crappy seats.
Good point. Yeah. Exactly.
And
I feel like Steve Martin at the end of Bowfinger. You get to right in front of the theater, right in front of the screen on the first row.
Yeah, be up in the balcony. Okay, yeah. Well, we're very happy for you. We hope you get even a fraction of that $55 million. And, you know.
No, none of that. None of that $55 million. That's none. That's not this.
I see our wonderful author, Sunjan, is here, but I want to ask you guys very quickly. Did you happen to read Ron Charles' piece last week?
Yes.
The article, yes. The Philip Roth biography is canceled. Mike Pence's book could be next, and publishing may never be the same.
Yes.
And he talks about why the Philip Roth biography got canceled because of a hashtag MeToo situation, mm-hmm. writ large.
Yeah.
And employees at publishing houses like Simon & Schuster writing mm-hmm. petitions saying, we don't want people from the Trump administration. And David, I think we've talked about this a little bit before. Mm-hmm. I struggle with this. On the one hand,
I do too.
Publishing houses are, it's not the government, right?
Yeah.
It's not. They get to publish what they want. Don't publish what they don't want to publish. These books tend to find other places and other ways to get out there.
Yeah.
At the same time, you want diversity of voices, even political voices. I can't stand it anymore, but somebody wants diversity of political voices. Mm-hmm. But David, you first, how do you feel about this?
You know, I guess I'm probably not as troubled as you are by it because number one, these books, you know, and I think Lewis certainly can speak to this better than I can, but we have a glut, I think, of books in the world. I mean, everybody thinks they're a brilliant author, don't they? And most people aren't. And most people's first books are just horrific. I'm sure my first, second, and third books will be awful. And will
that 18th is going to be awesome, though.
Exactly.
Awesome.
They'll be dreadful books, I know. But see, I guess where I would come down to it is the notion of centering, I think, is at play here. And again, whatever the book is about, the fact that so much of our culture is still centered in kind of cisgender white male, you know what I mean? Like, does the world have to, do we have to continue with that? Like forever? Is that what the main, do we never get to evolve to a different place? It doesn't mean you have to eliminate all of those people who write books. What bothers me is decisions made not because of genuine, you know, concerns if it's a Me Too situation. That's a genuine deal. You have to make a judgment on that, right? There can be, and certainly on the left as well as the right, there can be a tyranny of a kind of rush to judgment on people and ideas if we're not careful. When you get in your own various echo chambers, you tend to hear things that kind of validate your point of view, and you rarely go outside that bubble. And so you can very easily kind of think, well, this is what everybody thinks.
Right.
And it's not what everybody thinks. So I understand that. But I come back to what we've talked about before, Tori, which is these are private businesses. They can make up their minds about what they want to publish and not publish. It doesn't, you know, there's no one forcing them to publish or not publish. It's a business decision most of the time.
Right. Yep. Lewis, what do you think?
I struggle too. I am super progressive. I can't stand Mike Pence or Kellyanne Conway. Everything I read about Blake Bailey just makes me think, oh, God, this, what a swine. But I'm such a First Amendment absolutist. I'm such a First Amendment absolutist. And my feeling is you always let people talk because I'd rather hear what they have to say than have it driven underground. I'd rather know what people are saying in the world.
Right.
But I know it's complicated. And for some of the reasons that David brought up. And I don't know. It's
one of the interesting things for me was the employee, say at Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
Writing these petitions. And some people are very offended by that, going, it's not for them to decide this and that. Mm-hmm. And if anybody spent any time in the corporate world in the last 5-10 years, one of the most interesting things is, I work for SAP, big German software developer, always in the hunt for young talent, right? We wanted the young, smart, really, we were really out there looking for great people. And we increasingly learned that they not only wanted a good job and some good pay and good, some benefit, they wanted some voices in the decisions the company made. They wanted a sustainable company. They wanted a company that embraced every size, shape, shape, sex, gender, etc. They want, and some of the old timers were very offended by that. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, this is the way it is, right? 21st century corporations increasingly are affected by and influenced by, and I don't necessarily think it's a wrong thing, the employee base.
Right? But you're right. They're having to adjust, and it's hard for them.
For the
white cisgender guys on top to kind of adjust. Wait a minute. I have to listen to my employees. I don't.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm paying you. That's not enough.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, this is a fascinating time. I really want to hear what Sanjina has to say about this because.
Awesome segue to.
I love this segue.
Yeah.
Awesome segue. Sanjina, welcome to Chatter and Books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's pronounced Sanjina.
Sanjina. Thank you very much. And the last name, pronounce it correctly for us.
Sathian.
There we go. Okay. George Stephanopoulos, who I love, got it wrong. I saw that. So
very wrong.
Well, I pronounced Lewis's last name wrong for a year, and we finally got it right. But thank you so much for joining us. So you had an extensive body of work in places like the New York Times, the New Yorker, you name it, San Francisco Examiner, on and on and on, Boston. What made you as a writer make the switch from that kind of work, journalism, nonfiction, to this great book, Gold Diggers?
Some of it actually happened concurrently. So I have been writing like nonfictional essays in the last year in some of those outlets. But as you said, I was a journalist for 5 years. Journalism for me was really always kind of more of a side gig. It was my day job. All I ever really wanted to do was write fiction. So I was writing on the side. And then I left journalism to go to grad school when I got into an MFA program. And that just gave me the time and space to write. And that's where I was able to write Gold Diggers.
Yeah. So I've watched a lot of interviews and read a lot about you. You were a voracious reader as a child, right? You're a voracious reader when you were reading all these books. And tell us about that. Did you think, I want to write someday?
Yeah, I think as a kid, you see what you love and you want to participate in it, whether it's like loving basketball and immediately wanting to be a basketball player. That's what my brother went through. And for me, it was reading. I used to read these British boarding school novels that my mom brought with her from India that you don't really find in the US. My first writing, I think, was like fan fiction set at this fictional British boarding school.
Like Tom Brown's School Days? Are we talking that far back? Or
no, I mean, it's actually that sort of generation. It was called Mallory Towers by Enid Blyton.
Mm. Oh.
Oh my gosh.
And is that what you thought you wanted to write when you would grow up?
I mean, I always loved stories about school. I always loved, I mean, partially because like that reflects your experience at the time. I remember when like the Harry Potter books started coming out when I was and they actually, like, a lot of American readers don't know that they're in a tradition of school novels. And absolutely. I think people plugged it into like this fantasy tradition, but really they're very English stories about just making your way year by year through a school system and trying to come of age that way. And even a lot of the like adult fiction that I loved to read as I got older was about that time period. The Bell Jar, I mean, she's in her 20s, Catcher in the Rye, the novel, The Boot of Suburbia by Hanif Qureshi. A lot of it is about people in that age range, which also the age range of my characters in the first half of Gold Diggers.
So you were a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop 2019, right?
Yeah, that's when I finished.
So I think Anna North last week, right, David, was also
an Iowa Writers Workshop grad.
2 weeks ago. Yeah. But
it's almost like it's the premier writing program in the country or something.
I think someone should do a Netflix series on this place because authors are very, very tight-fisted with the information they dole out about what that experience is like. And I'm fascinated by it. So tell us what it's like. What is the Iowa Writers Workshop like? Do you live in a dorm? Do you eat lunch together? What happens?
No, I actually think a documentary crew tried to set up shop in the workshop the year after I left, and everyone was like revolted because they were. I mean, it would make an amazing reality show in a lot of ways.
Tell us why.
I mean, you put a bunch of people who love art, but have strong opinions about art in one place together. And it's like a productive collision of aesthetics, but it's and people don't all come in like with the same idea of like the platonic idea of what a short story should look like. So one of the things that happens is you enter a workshop and everyone's on an equal playing field. Everyone's opinions matter equally. And you realize that other people have some fundamentally different ideas from you about what a piece of short fiction or novel opening should look like. And I was listening to a podcast with George Saunders the other day, and I haven't read his new book. That's the sort of craft book about creating a story. But he does talk about this idea of radical preference, where you learn what your orientation toward art and fiction is by hearing other people's. And I suddenly realized what my opinions were, what I thought an ideal piece of fiction looked like, what I think an ideal sentence or phrase sounds like, in part because I realized that I didn't have the same ideas about that as other people. But it's an amazing institution, and the director Sam Chang has changed it a lot from, I think people have this idea of it as being like an old stodgy institution. And Sam, you know, she's a woman of color. She's the first woman, first person of color to direct the workshop. And she diversified it on every level, like not just like race, ethnicity, class, like geographical origins. She's done it on that level. But really what she's done is create people who do have, or bring in people who do have different ideas of what fiction can and should be. So you have people who graduate and go on to write children's fiction. You have people who go on to write that kind of like Raymond Carver story that the workshop is known for. And then you have a lot of like writers of color and experimental writers coming out of it. Guy who wrote like a Proustian zombie novel. So you just have a lot more texture there than I think people have in their picture of Iowa.
Right.
What was the vision you had to reject for your own work particularly?
Well, I came in writing short fiction primarily, and I realized that I wanted to write novels, and I had sort of gone into short fiction for part of my 20s because it was like a way of teaching myself to write a beginning, middle, and an end. But there is this kind of idea in short fiction that, you know, even if it's speculative or magical realism, it's about like a nice, neat psychological epiphany at the end of the story. It's about domesticity. There's the like show don't tell kind of thing. And I realized that a lot of what I love in fiction is messier than that. I like big, messy novels. I like novels that are ambitious and sprawling. I like narrators who have a lot of opinions, and you don't have that many narrators with a lot of opinions in like Raymond Carver short fiction. You also learn that like some of those things are culturally specific. Like I would hear from white people who grew up in like WASPy families that like all dialogue should be avoidant because no one talks about their feelings. And then like my Jewish friend would be like, we talk a lot.
Your Italian friend talks about
it. Right.
Yeah. So there's no single way of creating that narrative voice because it comes from human experience.
What was the greatest value for you there? Was it validation of what you were doing and what you wanted to do? Or did you actually learn things? Maybe it's learn things about crafting that sentence, that perfect paragraph.
Yeah. It was the validation. It was the time and space to write. I had some truly amazing teachers. Charlie D'Ambrosio, who taught me in my very first semester there, just like taught me about what a scene can do in a way that I just never would have understood. Otherwise, I studied with Sam and with Ayanna Mathis. Ayanna read my thesis and provided a lot of really intelligent insights. But I also think like the workshop is amazing because of the other people in it. So I didn't live in a dorm, as you were asking, but I lived in house with a poet and another novelist. And they were kind of as important in terms of like mentor, like they mentored me, I think, as much or more than the professors did. Like those were my conversation partners as I was writing. Those were the people who helped me unlock difficult parts of the book.
And do you stay in touch with them?
Yeah. They're still kind of my first go-to people. I think every time I make a breakthrough or hit a stumbling point on the fiction I'm working on now, I'll talk to my old roommates and be like, help. Save me.
I find this fascinating about writers. They are so eager are willing to reach out to fellow writers, and fellow writers are so willing to help.
Some. Yeah. Some. I would say that's true. Some.
Yeah, I don't think that's universal.
Lois, to whom can you describe somebody to whom you've reached out and they wouldn't help?
Me? Yeah. Oh no, it's I'm a little more closeted with my work, if I'm gonna use that word, and so I show it to relatively few people. That's just my damage, right?
Because you'd be crushed if somebody didn't say a lot of positive things.
You know, Sanjana will know that this is so personal. Whatever you're writing, even if it's not autobiographical, You have to be really comfortable with the people that you're sending it out to, and
someone could break it. Someone
right?
Else, yeah,
and teachers will do that. And yeah. or peers will do that. So
wow, David, you're always on deadlines, and there are time constraints. But yes. Do you reach out to some of your colleagues, some of your peers, and go, "Hey, I'm going down this path. Am I crazy, or is this the right direction to go?"
Sometimes. Often.
And are they sometimes helpful and sometimes not?
Sometimes they're helpful, yeah. But I mean, I hate to say this because it sounds so egotistical, but I'm sure it's probably the same for fiction writers. I know what I want to write. You know what I mean? Like after a while, I kind of have it in my head what I want to write. And it's like, you know, it's like the old, what they used to always say on, you know, the writers for SNL or The Simpsons or whatever show it was, we're just writing to make each other laugh. We don't really care if anybody else laughed, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm just writing to entertain myself, really. I hate to say that, but I it's like I've written stuff that's crap and I know it's crap, but I've also written stuff that I thought was really good.
You're your toughest critic. You're your toughest critic.
Yeah, well, sure, but everybody is, right?
Yeah.
Who isn't their toughest critic? But, you know, so... Yeah, sometimes I'll go, you know what, I'm thinking about doing it this way. Does that make sense? But for the most part, I'm with Lewis. I kind of keep my own counsel on these things because most of the time it is personal. Like you're putting yourself out there and you don't want to be rejected. I mean, that's kind of a universal human trait, isn't it? Rejection is awful.
Obviously, I don't write. I am the exact opposite. I have 15 crazy ideas on any given day, and I will walk down the street and hit up six random strangers and go, is this me? Five of them will say yes, and one of them will go, no, that's a great idea. And I'll go with the drunk, looking over the bridge every time. Okay, let's get to Gold Diggers, which is just a fabulous, fabulous book. Nobody can see it on our podcast, but I'm holding up because it's a great cover too. Give us the elevator pitch, Ms. Author. Give us the elevator pitch. What did you say to your agent, your fellow writers, here's the book I want to write?
Well, I definitely didn't start it that way. I definitely didn't start, here's the book I want to write. I wrote it and other people had to tell me how to pitch it. My roommate actually wrote my query letter for me.
That's great.
You know what you've made. You're not starting out with an agenda, but the novel is about a teenage boy. He starts out as a teenager. We pick up again 10 years later and follow him over the course of his teens and 20s, but his name is Neil. He's kind of an Indian American slacker, stoner, kind of an underachiever in his community where everyone is very obsessed with high achievement. And he is sort of starting to grow apart from his childhood best friend, the girl next door, who he's also in love with, Anita. And he finds out that Anita, who is doing really well and kind of the golden child of their community. He learns that part of the reason she's doing so well is that she and her mother have been stealing gold from other members of the community, and they do a little magic with it and end up stealing the ambitions and energies of other people in the community. So it's really kind of about a minority community cannibalizing itself and competition getting the better of people. The novel picks up, as I said, 10 years later in Silicon Valley, where all of these people are in their 20s, and it's kind of a different ambition race in the tech world. And there are cutaways to 1980s Bombay and 1849 Gold Rush, California.
Yeah. Okay. So for anybody who has not yet bought the book, and you will go buy Gold Digger soon, it sounds a little crazy that they steal gold and they turn it into this magic elixir. You read the book and you go, well, yeah, absolutely. And it makes absolute total sense. But as we were saying at the start of the show, it's coming of age, it's identity, it's America in the 21st century. Kind of going back to the Iowa Writers Workshop, how did you write the book? Was there a process by which you had these various themes and you outlined them? Or was it more organic and more flowing?
Yeah, I definitely don't start with themes or outlines. I'm what one of my college professors call a vomit drafter. So
nice. Tell us what vomit drafter means.
It just means I've got to produce a lot before I know what I'm dealing with. I have to write from multiple characters' perspectives. So I actually wrote from Anita, the neighbor's perspective, for a large part of like the opening uh-huh. book. Then I wrote from her mother's perspective. The novel kind of actually began in, as a short story that was kind of light and playful about a mother and a daughter who were gold thieves. And the daughter was reminiscing about it in adulthood. And the story just bombed in workshop.
What does that mean?
I was going to say, what are the signs? What are the signs?
Oh, there was not like, it was not subtle. The professor had like a lesson at the end of each class, and the lesson would be like, you know, here's your one takeaway about how to write dialogue. Here's your one takeaway about how to write a scene. The takeaway for that short story was failure. What to do
wow.
when you have written something that fails to be. But he was right. He was right. It didn't work. But what did work was this conceit. And to his great credit, he pointed me in that direction. He was like, this isn't a story, but there's something in here that might be not only a story, but more. And my roommate was in that class as well. And he was like, this gold conceit, like it could sustain a Chabon novel. And I wow. was like, oh, I see that. Yeah. So I followed that. And I head hopped out of Anita's perspective and into Neil. And Neil just gave me kind of the right entree into the world. And once I was writing this, you know, I was writing about gold theft, and I kind of groped my way to these themes about ambition, achievement culture, like Indian American and Asian American identity, this model minority myth. All of that stuff came much later once I realized that those were the concerns of my childhood. Those are the concerns that I have now looking back on my childhood. So they were there in the novel, but I certainly wasn't like while I was writing it, walking around saying, I'm writing a critique of the model minority narrative. I was writing a magical realist story about my childhood.
But clearly, and again, I've watched enough interviews, I can say this. Okay, wait, Ovi the dog is about to jump into our Zoom call here because he wants to be let out. Hi, Ovi. How much of it did you consciously think of as autobiographical? Your experience in high school, your experience as an Indian American, your experience finding your way, being ambitious. How much of that was you thinking to yourself, okay, this is what I went through, so now I'm going to write it? And how much of it was other people that you might have experienced in your life?
Well, it's both, right? I think when you're in like the mulch of fiction writing brain, you're just drawing on, it's like it's intuition or impulse or hazy memory. And, I think novelists often have like unreliable memories, which is helpful because you're already fictionalizing. So I was, even know if this is a fair, recollection of what it was like, but my brain has already done part of that work. So now I'm going to follow it. The big thing I drew on was I drew on my memories of the suburbs of Atlanta where I grew up, which is where that first half takes place. I drew on kind of memories of being in like an extremely competitive, like sort of subculture of Indian Americans surrounded by white people. And that kind of infused the story. But ultimately, like I was writing a character who was unlike me because he's a teenage boy. I was writing, I was writing magic. So obviously that's automatically not realist. So the plot and these characters kind of went ahead without me. And then when I needed to, I just had all of this to draw on when I needed to sort of fill in the stuff around it. But plot really led rather than autobiography.
Right. That's fascinating. But you've in the book, Gold Diggers, which is friends, relatives, Indian American Society of the United States, how have your current friends, relatives, colleagues, peers, et cetera, how have they reacted to the story? Should they see themselves in it? Do they like it? Are they offended by some of it? What's the reaction been of the people closest to you?
I'm sure some of them are offended by it. I think there's been a lot more like pleasant response than I would have expected of just people sort of in the general Indian community, not necessarily people who I grew up with, but people who are maybe a degree away from me. People who are just writing into my website saying like, I grew up in an Indian community a lot like this one. And there's a lot of like, I see myself in this. And I think there's a lot of conversation, much of it really inane, about representation these days. And I didn't like write this book so that like other brown people could see themselves. I wrote it because I had to write it, and because I had both a lot of love for and a lot of like critical feelings about the community that I grew up in. And so what's been most valuable is hearing from people who not only see themselves, but felt like they were in conversation with like real challenging ideas about like whether or not the values that some of us were raised on were like good for us in the long run, whether or not it's good to sort of raise your kids on this diet of like pure ambition and thoughtless achievement culture. So that's been really affirming.
Right.
But not everyone is there in terms of agreeing with me about that.
What I love though, is there's a universality to this too. It's not just brown culture. It's just, I grew up in that home. I grew up at Harvard, the Lodestone. My oldest brother got there first. It's like, what am I going to do? He's already there. What do I do? And that sense of hyper achievement. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously very different through a white WASP family, but I kind of feel some of that vibe too.
Yeah. I mean, that's also been really, really great to hear, is like, I think people sometimes see like book by ethnic author, like you must have written this like only so that people like you could be represented, quote unquote. And actually, like, I've been hearing from, you know, like one of my friends who is not Indian and like worked in tech was like, this book was for me because it helped me be in conversation with like my own complicated feelings about ambition, period. And another friend of mine read it and was like, actually, this book is like sort of about race, but it's also just about capitalism. And that was like,
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you were that voracious reader and you wanted to be a writer growing up, was that ambitious enough for you growing up?
A lot of that sort of like pure love of reading, I was lucky to have that relationship develop before the sort of like overt pressures of achievement culture, like bearing down on me. Like that was elementary school, middle school. I was just reading. I was thinking about ideas all the time. And maybe I wasn't like relating exactly to the sort of like Ivy obsession that hit later. In high school, I definitely felt like there was like a divide between what I was doing in school and doing as like a policy debater, which kind of took up all of my time.
Right.
All of the stuff I was doing like to get to the fanciest college possible. And then the stuff that like privately meant a lot to me, the stuff that really comprised my inner life, which was like, being up really late and reading and rereading the short stories assigned in my Spanish lit class or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the sort of striving to get into the fancy school, but no, it wasn't enough to just be a reader.
Yeah. Okay. So segue to, you know, Sublime to Ridiculous, without giving away too much in the book, Gold Diggers, you wrote about beauty pageants. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? Why did you happen to put, did you have some obsession with, do you have friends or relatives that were involved? It's a really interesting part. I found it a really interesting, important part of the book, but how did you include that? Where did that come from?
I actually don't really know where it came from. In college, I wrote a short story about a fictional sort of like absurd beauty pageant called the New America pageant that was like about like quote unquote multicultural girls being invited to perform their multiculturalism by like doing like performing an opera in an indigenous dialect from your country or something. Like it was just about the ways that we are invited to perform identity, particularly women of color. But that was just sort of like, I really don't know where it came from. I think it came from this idea of what you're asked to do to introduce yourself to the world when you're an outsider, and pageantry is just an extreme example of that. But I never went to like the pageant in the book that you're alluding to is the Miss Teen India pageant, for those people who haven't read it, which is a real beauty pageant. And I think that's even more interesting than the like fictional multiculturalism pageant that I had written all those years ago, because it's about a community trying to articulate itself to itself. Like it is a formation of a public sphere. And that is like a fascinating political and social thing to witness. So I just watched a lot of like YouTube videos of Miss Teen India pageants, and like it's stranger than fiction. I couldn't even.
Yeah, all of them are.
Did you reach any conclusions about assimilation at the end of your book? I mean, because there's always a back and forth, I know, about it.
Great
we question. Have it. Everybody has it, right? We're all trying, but assimilate to what? I always say, what are we assimilating to? You know, so I wonder what your conclusions were at the end of it.
Yeah, I don't know that I had conclusions. I think I had new fears. I have new fears. Wow. Like, I think that they're like the sort of story of immigration, particularly second generation kids in immigrant families, has been so often like, parents, leave us alone, let us be the American teenagers, like, let us date who we want to date, blah, blah, blah. And like, okay, that's sort of the vibe that you get in the first half of the book, because that is what it felt like when I was a teenager. But fast forward, and particularly the Indian diaspora, because of all of the conditions under which we are caused to emigrate here, which is like a lot of us are quote unquote high skilled workers. And so there's like class and caste and all these other privileges, which means we are like a highly elite, overly educated, like one of the richest communities in the US. So when you take a community like that and you say, okay, you've started to assimilate, you're not just assimilating into whiteness, you're assimilating into like real power, and power that is potentially corrupting and dangerous and can breed complacency and conservatism. And I have started to see that in my community, is like people who identified as outsiders and felt like outsiders and were made to feel like perpetual foreigners when we were younger, they now are very powerful, but have not yet figured out that they're powerful, and they're not acting on that new power. And to put it bluntly, that means like a lot of them are like, I think, on the wrong side of affirmative action debates, because they're like continuing to believe that they're discriminated against, when in fact, maybe you need to think about the fact that like you've sort of made it here. And so can you bridge an empathy gap between like people who actually are more disenfranchised? So I wrote my way to actually a lot more anger with my community. And what I see are sometimes like technocratic desires to assimilate as like greedy, not just like let's belong, but let's fund this place.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Again, without giving too much away about gold diggers, there's a crime committed. A fabulous crime. Did you study crime? Did you look up all sorts of plots? How did you come up with that?
Well, so there are a lot of petty thefts in the first half, because there are gold thefts. And those I didn't do that much research for. I spent a little bit of time thinking about, like, I think I read this like academic monograph on like Victorian women who stole, like Victorian wives who stole, and it gave me nothing. not useful there. I just had to do character work there. In the second half, there is a larger crime, and what
complex crime, a very complex crime. Yeah.
And it takes place at an Indian wedding expo. and for that, I actually did have to like plot a heist. And so I went to a wedding expo, and for anyone who hasn't been to one of these carnivals,
I've not. I must.
You might not come out alive. It's basically a bazaar of like every vendor you could potentially need to put on your big fat Indian wedding. And so like there are people who will hook you up with like the horse that the bridegroom might want to ride in on. There are DJs, there are fashion shows, there are henna artists for the mehndi. There's just like everything you could imagine. And it's pretty tacky, but also there's something sort of charming, and I felt very familiar about, like, you don't have the immigrants, you don't have the space to just like walk into David's Bridal if you're trying to put on like a sort of ethnically traditional wedding. And so you do have to kind of gather everything and do it at full volume and kind of overcompensate because you're in the margins. And so I went to one of these in the suburbs of Chicago for research, and I felt both like a lot of love for my community and also like a lot of like facepalm energy of just like way up wail about the makeup that they needed. So it was fun to plot that crime, but it's definitely got some slapstick in it, even though there's something really serious going
on. Did you attract any attention while you were plotting that crime? Were you taking notes in some suspicious way that had security guards coming down here?
Yeah, I went up to one of the gold vendors and I was like, can you tell me how secure your wares are? I'm like doing some research for a book. And he was like, I'm not going to talk to you.
Okay. There were so many scenes in the book that created visuals in my mind, but the expo really top of the list. And speaking of scenes, so Mindy Kaling has optioned or has it gone further to do, right? For a TV series or a movie?
TV series.
Yeah. This is spectacular. Okay, so we're gonna. This is the bookend of this the show. Tell us about that. Who first called you? Were you excited, thrilled? Mindy Kaling's a big deal, and she gets some really wonderful work done. So tell us about the process. How you found out? How it's all going? When will it all happen? And when will we get to see it on our screens?
Well, we're in very early stages. An option is, you know, step one out of a million to actually make something happen. But we are interviewing showrunners. Which is super exciting. So we're like actively talking to the person who will co-write with me, and that person will also be the showrunner. So I'll be co-writing the adaptation.
Wow.
So in that stage, which is really exciting. I mean, as far as hearing about it, my agent just sent it to her Hollywood co-agent when we went to publishers. So it was going out to like LA people around the same time that it was going out to New York publishers. And they sent it to Mindy's people. And I remember her telling me that. And I was like, okay, like file that away. That's going to be irrelevant. But I guess she connected with it. She likes badly behaved brown people. And I like badly behaved brown people. So there's some shared aesthetic sensibilities. And last summer, we got on the phone with her and the president of her production company, Jessica Kamai Scott. And it was, what was so thrilling was not just like, this is a famous person whose work I really admire, but this is a famous person whose work I really admire, who had like really engaged with this thing when it was literally a Word doc that appeared on her computer.
I mean, I'm really curious, what kind of things did she ask you or talk about in that phone call?
Well, she said it hadn't, she hadn't connected with material with a male lead in a while, which is funny.
Interesting.
A lot of people have noticed that like my narrator is male and I am not, but
really they picked up on that.
it's like those literary types. They are so smart.
But you know, it's also a story about women and
yeah, very much so.
Fairly strong women. And so I think she was noticing that. They really connected with kind of the mix of comedy and drama, which I think is like a hard mix to figure out for.
Sure.
But it felt like they understood already kind of what tone to go with there. And they understood that I wanted to preserve some of the irreverence while also, you know, doing the drama and kind of scaling it up. Yeah, it's been really exciting.
That's fabulous. I read somewhere, and I'm sure some highbrow publication like People or ET or something like that, that she is really, truly remarkable in the talent she sees, what she does with it, and the material that she brings to life. But she wants to move to some vehicles that have some drama to them, that have some weight to them. And this is a great vehicle. So awesome. So in the next year, 5 years, when do we get to see something, do you think? Realizing there are 1,000 steps.
Yeah, I mean, right now it's like step by step where we'll find someone for me to work with. That person and I will put together like the pitch deck, envision the season. We'll go pitch networks. If a network wants us, then hopefully we'll be writing a pilot in, you know, maybe the next year or two. But these things take forever. With TV, so many people are involved in a way that isn't true in fiction. So.
It's awesome. And it's based on
whatever it is.
Great book, Gold Diggers. I said at the start of the show, and I really mean this, it's one of the most innovative, creative things. I've got 1,000 more questions, but I'll have to send them via email. David, did you just text me with something?
What
did
you text me? I did. Just check it out. So
okay. Okay,
Go. This is such a cool book. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I'm always curious and any author that's on the call now can answer this. When you set up a scene, I remember a scene early in the book where they're having a party and Neil's trying to help out and he's, you know, he's vibing about his next door neighbor love. And you describe things like food and dress. And there and people who aren't familiar with that are reading your book. Do you care if what they see is different than what you know is to be what is true?
Great question.
It's an interesting question. Yeah, people have been asking me the question of audience here and there, but I no one's asked it in those terms. I guess I don't, because in some ways, like if I stopped to explain, not only would it be sort of, it would break the narrative, but it would be out of character.
Yeah.
And like Neil wouldn't be annotating it to himself. And so one thing, I mean, like Viet Thanh Nguyen talks about this all the time with like telling minority writers to just write as though you're the majority and like, catch up. So I think in, like, not as though I had like a political agenda to do that, but that's just how I had to write. It's just the only way to make the scenes function.
Right. No, it was it's fascinating. That's always fascinating to me because it recenters, which is what I was talking about before. Like, well, you figure out what it is. You look it up and it, you know what I mean? Like, and I love that. Like, I got to learn now. That's good. That's a good thing. You know, that's wonderful.
What's next? Last question. What's next?
I'm getting back to work. I don't talk about work in progress for some of those reasons. That
I don't either. I'm always afraid.
Yeah. Back to work.
That's great. Well, thank you for being with us. The book is Gold Diggers. It's really, really fabulous. And Sanjana, stay with us for just a quick second because did your colleague tell you that we have Deserted Island at the end? We're going to ask you for a recommendation.
Excellent. Island discs or what?
Yes. Yeah, Deserted Island is a very long story. We won't bore you with that. But a little bit of housekeeping, and then we'll go to Deserted Island. So the housekeeping is the usual. Download us, write reviews if you're feeling nice about us. And next week, we're coming back with somebody who's been on before, Admiral James Stavridis, who is a fabulous writer, and he's turned to fiction. It's called 2034. It starts with a mishap in the South China Sea between the United States and China, and it escalates to a global disaster. Quite scary, quite realistic, and he's a fabulous guest, so we look forward to having him. And now, Deserted Island, in honor of Mother's Day coming up about a week from now, is Mother's Day picks. And I'm going to go first because mine is just the worst, the absolute worst. And mine is Book Psycho by
Robert Bloch.
Bloch, which I didn't know this until I went to research it. The movie, Alfred Hitchcock movie, was based on this book, which came out in 1959. It was one of the bestsellers of all time, an absolutely twisted tale, of course. And if you really want to scare yourself, don't just see the movie or read this book. The book was loosely based on a guy named Ed Bein, B-E-I-N.
I think it's G-E-I-N, yes.
G-E-I-N. One of the most horrific serial murderers of all time.
Yeah.
You know, I love Criminal Minds, but the things that I did.
That's a very warm choice. That's awful. A very warm choice.
Yeah. So, well,
thank you for that sweet.
That's my Mother's Day. Okay, Lewis, make it sweeter. What do you got?
I was going to go with The Handmaid's Tale, like the heroine of The Handmaid's Tale. she's trying to get back to her kid. It's like, come on. I feel like that's the engine under the whole thing. And whatever she's enduring is that her child is taken away from her. So she's
okay, the one. I go with that. David?
Yeah. All right, I'm going to cheat a little because it's a podcast about books, but I'm going to cheat because I had to. The book Chocolat by Joanne Harris.
Yeah.
I saw the movie. A wonderful movie. And I love the movie. And it's a great, wonderful, sweet movie about kind of mysticism and belief and love of your child and love of a mother and making people kind of get outside of themselves and risk some things that they normally wouldn't risk and change. At a very difficult time when people weren't changing, especially in that part of the world during World War II. I thought it was a wonderful, sweet movie, and I'm sure the book is just as good.
I think that's absolutely fine, and people sometimes poo-poo that, but if a movie causes you to think about or go pick up a book, that's a good thing. And if a book makes you think about or go see a movie, that's a good thing too. We like hybrids.
Synergy. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Sanjana, Mother's Day pick?
I was thinking conceptual and a little dark, like the first two. the Sheila Hetty book, Motherhood, about whether or not to have children. And she uses the I Ching to think through whether or not to have a child. And I think it's great. I think, like, you know, sometimes for Mother's Day, the attitude is like, pick something that's affirming of a bunch of values you already hold. And I think that book is great for getting you to question the institution at all.
I like that.
Outstanding.
Okay, on a happier note, everyone should buy Gold Diggers for Mother's Day. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Claude, thanks for making everything happen, my friend. And everyone, stay well. Continue to wash your hands, wear masks when you're in crowded spaces. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys.